Retro Nerd.
Entering the hive of scum and villainy.
I love democracy.
We shall have order!
The old Senate will no longer be of any concern to us.
My allegiance is to the Republic, to democracy!
Rebellions are built on hope.
Your focus determines your reality.
Luke, you're going to find that many of the truths we cling to depend greatly on our own point of view.
Hello, and welcome to Beltway Banthas, a Star Wars podcast live from the hive of scum and villainy in our very own galaxy, Washington, D.C. I'm your host, Stephen Kent, and today we're having a conversation on empathy, why it matters, what Star Wars has to say about it, and how we are slowly losing it in our own lives, in the public square, and in our politics. To do this, I wanted to reconvene some friends of the show, Danielle Adams and Nick DeCalandria. You are familiar with them if you have been listening to this show for any period of time. And we just talk about a little bit of the contents of my chapter on empathy from my upcoming book, How the Force Can Fix the World: Lessons on Life, Liberty, and Happiness from a Galaxy Far, Far Away, as well as some of the things that are in the news that are driving our concern with the lack of empathy in our world today. It's amazing to me how some of the ways we have built our modern world, where we are more exposed to things and people and ideas than ever, just by nature of being interconnected in the internet, has also allowed us to turn off our capacity for feeling and walking in other people's shoes as a result of sort of self-selection and user preference. I mean, you hear a lot about this in the debate over Facebook and Twitter and echo chambers and who you follow and who follows you as sort of defining the world in which you live in and the kind of things that you see. But it absolutely is true. We have the ultimate power suite of tools to be more empathetic people in 2021, but we are increasingly ordering our lives around tools that kind of prioritize the opposite and reward the opposite. It is a tough situation to be in, and we're going to talk about it right now. But first, before the episode begins, I just want to say something, which is that at the end of the episode, we kind of wrap abruptly. We were already reaching the end of the interview, the end of the discussion on empathy. And one of my guests, Danielle, really, I think, graciously shared some information with me that I was not aware of. And I kind of panicked and I was like, oh my gosh, I got to wrap the episode, because one of the people who inspired greatly the book that I just completed and is up for pre-orders right now, I learned that he passed away in the course of recording this episode. I'd met Pastor Bishop Omar Jawar in 2019 when I was doing a program in DC, and he came to speak to the people in my fellowship program about criminal justice reform and working with young men behind bars who were in the gang life, and how Bishop would reach out to them in prison and work with them and try to get them to exit the violent life of gangs. He led an organization by the name of Urban Specialists in Dallas, Texas. And the whole function of Urban Specialists was to have this nonprofit mediating gang disputes on the streets to stop violence from happening, to stop bullets from flying between rival gangs, because there are a lot of organizations out there dedicated to pulling young men out of gangs and getting them to, you know, exit the life and get legitimate work and take care of their families different ways. And Bishop Omar, the premise of Urban Specialists was that the thing that makes that sometimes really hard for young men in gangs to do is because the cycle of violence is constant. Retribution between gangs is always going back and forth, and there's always payback to be delivered for whatever. And so the thing that you have to do to stop gun violence and stop murders in your inner cities is you have to actually like stop the beef between gangs. And so Urban Specialist mediates and offers discourse between different street leaders to actually stop violence. And then healing begins and people are able to be pulled out of those situations altogether. It was a really unique project and it really inspired me when I was writing the chapter on empathy and seeing underneath the masks of people who you do find to be frightening and people who are incarcerated and people who are in violent gangs, I think represent that for a lot of people, not just myself. And when I was talking about that in the episode, Danielle, I suppose, Googled him and noted that he passed away 3 months ago. He got COVID. And he had complications from it and he died. I did not know. I had talked to him 2 times over the past year via Zoom to inform some of the stuff that I was writing and pick his brain about a couple of different concepts I was toying around with for the chapter. And, you know, it's just one of those things. I didn't get notified. We weren't like best of friends. I didn't get notified when he passed away and it just really caught me off guard. So I just kind of wrapped up the episode quickly because I just needed to collect my thoughts. But we're going to do a part two of this episode because we got deep into this subject and not deep enough. And I want to go another layer further. So we're going to do a part two on this in the month ahead. So stay tuned. And without any further ado, let me get out of the way. And this is my conversation with Nick DeCalandria and Danielle Adams on Star Wars, Politics, and Empathy. Well, guys, we're going to be talking today a little bit on this episode of Beltway Banthas about Star Wars and empathy. And when I was thinking about putting together sort of this episode on why the virtue of empathy matters at all, why we should even be talking about it, I thought that it was necessary to call on 2 friends who I think to be very effective empaths. So, you know, both Nick and Danielle, it's nice to have you here for this. I'd like to begin us by reading a passage from my book, How the Force Can Fix the World, Lessons on Life, Liberty, and Happiness from a Galaxy Far, Far Away. Everyone out there listening to the show, the next 6 months of Beltway Banthas will be a lot of talking about the book. That is just sort of the nature of writing this thing and then rolling it out. So to kick us off, I would like to paint a picture of where Star Wars sort of, I thought, made one of its most powerful messages about why empathy matters and how it can like disrupt your worldview. So here we go. This is the beginning of chapter 2 on empathy. Rey had nowhere to go. She'd been captured by Kylo Ren, the ghoulish villain we first meet in Star Wars Episode 7, The Force Awakens, during a battle on the forest planet of Takodana. "You still want to kill me," Kylo says to her in his garbled robotic voice, filtered by the mask he chooses to wear. "That happens when you're being hunted by a creature in a mask," Rey snaps back at him. What happens next has always struck me when I watch The Force Awakens. Ren says nothing. He simply steps back from Rey, reaches for his helmet, and pulls it off, slamming it down on the table next to him with a crashing thud. Rey looks bewildered and suddenly uncomfortable in a way her being held captive doesn't quite explain. Ren is human. He's a young man, handsome too. This frightful character was not some ghoul, and he wasn't that different from Rey. Her eyes flittered, she squinted. Was this really what was beneath the mask of Kylo Ren? Have you had that kind of experience before? A moment where your perception of a person or group was shattered in an instant by some act of vulnerability or humility, and suddenly the person who stood before you was not a monster, but just a person? I hope you have, but if I'm being honest, these moments are harder and harder to come by in a world completely and increasingly ordered by user preference. Empathy is basically one person's ability to understand or relate to the feelings of another. It's a value that goes beyond teaching your kids how to make friends on the playground. Empathy is more important to society at large than just providing married couples a tool to navigate conflict. empathy is part of the fabric of democracy. True or false, Nick, Danielle, is empathy like that sort of a all-encompassing value that like works from the smallest level to the largest level? Because this whole book is about like making the world a better place, and I try to make things as like big and interconnected as possible. What say you?
No, it's funny. I just had a conversation with my mother yesterday about empathy and the need to be the example to people about it. So it's really odd that, you know, you were like, let's talk about empathy tonight or whatever you did. You reached out and I was like, that's really odd. The force is speaking to us in weird, mysterious ways.
What was the conversation?
Family and your some people's inabilities to put yourselves in other people's shoes and understand mistakes are always made and things are always said. And there are times to be the olive branch and to see yourself in somebody else's shoes and see what they might have gone through at a younger time in their life or even currently, but to empathize with their own plight and their own issues and struggles and achievements and lack of thereof, and empathize and sympathize in some situations that make it so incredibly vital and important that if you can't do that, then basic structures of family just break down and take it to the next level. Everything else goes with it. And, I think to a certain level, the ability for empathy to be a catalyst for positive growth and change and humanity survival. Right. I mean, I think you're spot on. I think it is exactly, correct. We tend to willingly or unwillingly shield ourselves from trying to let our guard down to just be able to see somebody else's life stance or point of view when it's necessary. When you have an opportunity to give that person to take off their mask, if you'd understand where you can bridge certain divides. I think empathy is underutilized more so now than perhaps any time in my very young life. But
I think that point about protection is a big part of it. Our own guard and letting it down and seeing beyond mask is, it's a lot of defensive positioning. Danielle, I'm sure you want to comment on that kind of more broadly, but I'm curious just to put a question to you. With the Star Wars anecdote and sort of Rey having that moment where Kylo takes his mask off and she's kind of like, huh, wait a second. Like there was like this weird like connection. Some people call it chemistry. Other people just like she was a little caught off guard that he wasn't like some beast. Have you ever had a moment like that you can call on where you just were sort of put off your footing by another person?
So I would say yes and no. I consider myself like a pretty huge empath, and it's not even something I just consider about myself. It's something that others see in me. So it's rare that I'm caught off guard because I have a really highly tuned sense of what other people are thinking and feeling. And I can share in that space. I think that sort of intuition and that empathetic like value or skill that I have, again, it kind of guards me from being caught off guard. But I think people are still capable of surprising you mm-hmm. in ways. But I think I approach most folks that way. So not so much where I'm just like jarred, but I would like to like step back and be like, it was not chemistry. between those two, and I will fight to the death, and that is a hill I am willing to die on.
And I'm sorry, the chemistry came in the next movie with the hand touching.
I completely rebuke that whole narrative, and I refuse to believe that was a part of the film, even though I saw it with my own eyes. You can't convince me that that was a part of it. Me as an empath with all my feelings, I'm like, nope, none of that is there. I think people can surprise you. I'll use our relationship as sort of the standard. Like, I didn't come in thinking you had any malice or, like, you know, false things. But, you know, at first when someone's like, oh, you know, he worked for Koch brothers and the libertarian conservative. And I'm like, ugh, not my people. like, nope, we don't have anything in common, you know. But like our first lunch, I think you and I got like tacos or something, and we just walked, and I was like, he's one of my people. He's mm-hmm. like, how is he my people, but we're on this different spectrum. But it wasn't like it was just caught off guard because I didn't know you. So I guess it is like you were a person in a mask, right? Like through someone else telling me, it was like, you should meet Stephen Kent. He has a Star Wars podcast. You should talk about Star Wars things and politics. And I'm like, he worked for Coke Industries or like the Coke? No, like, no way.
Yeah. And I think like the kind of like the backstory for people listening is, Nick introduced Danielle and I, because we both work in political nonprofits. For me, worked past tense. And so we decided to get kind of like brunch in Raleigh and just talk about Star Wars and what we do. And, you know, I guess like boiled down to the most simple ways of describing it, like I was working and spent most of my post-grad years working in the Koch brothers political action network, doing conservative and libertarian politics. Danielle on the George Soros side of things. Yes. in George Soros's left-wing political action web of groups. We call ours the Coke-tipus. I don't know what you call yours. It's the octopus with all the tentacles. It's an amazingly villainous way to describe yourselves. but yeah, so like one of the things that I thought was really interesting about doing that get together and that meet is like, you know, you like play for different teams and you obviously have very different, I don't want to say values, but like political opinions about stuff. But like just the mere fact that you both work in nonprofit politics for sort of these big, larger than life people at the very top of the food chain, you're very idealistic. You believe in things. That almost like is a grounds to just have a lot in common because you're a believer working in this bureaucracy. And you just like immediately have something to talk about. Like, wow, I feel like we never like do the things that we're trying to do. I don't know. I just remember walking away with like a sense of camaraderie after that.
Yeah. And so I think that was one of the things where it's like, you were a person in a mask that I was just sort of told like, hey, you should chat with the person. And I was had my pre, but like immediately, like as soon as like we sat down and I was like, oh, they are people, you know, that this is my... This part of my community, which is like a belief that I wouldn't have like that I didn't come into that. I wasn't open to, or I was open to the interaction, right? But I had already created in my mind like, this is who you are. You are the bad guy. You work for the bad guys. You know, you're not on my team, as you said. So I think that's one of like the closest instances. But being an empath is part of that, and I hope we can discuss further because I think both of you have like a very altruistic view of empathy as like an as someone who is an empath, and like empathy is not as nice as you all are making it sound right now, so even in the Star Wars universe. So
yeah I mean, can so maybe like can you unpack that, like I don't even know kind of like what exactly you mean by like,
yeah, I mean,
like an altruistic view. Could you define that and then say like why it doesn't always, it's not always nice?
Well, I mean, you read the definition of empathy earlier, right? Like the ability to understand.
I read my definition.
the ability to like understand others and put yourself in their shoes. And like that's the role, right? Like, I feel what you feel and I understand why you feel that way. That's not always kindness, right? Like, as an empath, like I can empathize with you and use that to my advantage. And I think there are folks who are, and especially in the Star Wars universe, who have that sort of skill and that sensitivity and use it for ill. So I think the ability, just the way you both opened it up, like the ability to have empathy as something that is a positive, it's like, yes, like we should have more empathy and it should be a tool used for good. But you can also be an empath and have empathy and use it to manipulate others.
Yeah. And I think the way that breaks down, and I want to get Nick back in here, so I'm not talking too much here, but like two examples, I think. So one, Palpatine, right? Like sensing someone's feelings, a Sith, you know, someone in his position, like he can sense raw emotion in people. And you know, he sees an Anakin distress, anxiety, fear, and love, like a deep love for his secret wife, and just a desire in him for something. And then, you know, there is a version of an empath, and there's a long chain of empaths who are incredibly manipulative, like psychotic personalities in our own world, who can see that and they can feel it, but they are primarily motivated by a desire to, I don't even think they view it as like controlling that person. I think they tend to view it as just like furthering what is ever is good for them. Like, and they just trick themselves through some sort of like weird way of thinking about it. Like, I am helping them by helping myself. And you manipulate people. And then the other version of that is Rey. I guess Rey Palpatine, who, when she comes across that snake in the desert, in the tunnel, and she sees that it is wounded and it is being aggressive, it's lashing out like some sort of, like any animal you might see in like an old Steve Irwin documentary or something like that. Like, she sees that it's hurting and her approach is like, you are in pain. I'm going to approach you in a way that doesn't stress you out anymore. And I'm going to do what I can to take your pain away. And there is no assertion of dominance between her and that other creature. Like, she's another version of an empath, but not someone who's manipulating others.
No, that was good. That was good. I'm speechless. Now, I think it's really interesting to think of empathy too, as you guys are talking about the good and the dark side of using any kind of emotional tool or weapon for or against your own personal interests or for others, is that there are examples rife of that in the Star Wars universe and even in our own. And I'm trying to think of something besides the Kylo Ren Rey moment where like Kylo Ren takes his masks off and reveals himself to be a person. I think a lot of it might be in the nuance or backfill between stories for some, let's say like Luke Skywalker, right? And how does he come to terms with understanding what his father did and why he did it? You know, or even Leia understanding why her father did what he did. Like, and if there's even know the background, like we know the background, right? Like that those kind of things. And you're talking about like Palpatine manipulating folks, and how successful that was for Anakin throughout his whole life. And for the little bit of there, that was successful for Padme. But then in Phantom Menace, where he manipulates her, you know, planets and her emotions to save her people, to his further his gain, but, you know, empathizing, you know, with her and saying, well, this is not, you have, you know, you could do this. If only there's a stronger leader, you know, like, and you could have what you need. And that gets the whole thing rolling. But then I would say there are then, again, not in the movies, but if you end up watching Clone Wars, you see how, you know, Padme uses empathy to try to figure out and understanding the other side. And then we are able to, through a lot of these really good storylines, through Mandalore and through with Padme and the Separatists and these, you know, what would feel like for most folks to just want to, again, leave politics out of Star Wars. You can't. I know everybody who listened to this podcast realizes that, but for those of you who haven't, you're new to the show, you can't. You know, she makes those attempts to understand the Separatists, and she tries to build peace. And even in the cutscenes for Revenge of the Sith, there is this whole movement to, you know, why aren't we doing more to understand where they're coming from and understand the mechanisms of war and how this affects. And like, there is that level of empathy too that I hear you, Danielle. It can be utilized. We have examples both in the real world and in Star Wars that it can be. But at the same time, you know, it can be balanced out. There are those individuals that resist that temptation and do put it to use that, unfortunately, especially in the Star Wars universe, and it's not like highly elevated, right? It's like, this is how these things can be used. But in the good ways, we'll, you know, not maybe we're not going to highlight as much, which does a disservice to some of those more powerful, tangible emotions that folks need to feel more of in our world.
So I like the word that you use there, like it balances it out. And, you know, that's really what we look for when we talk about the Force, is like this balance of light and dark, good and evil. So yeah, you're right. There are examples of that. And, you know, I know, Stephen, you'll talk about this like later on and maybe go into more detail, or you sort of alluded to it. And when we started, like this sort of decline and empathy and where we are. And I think that's like sort of like why we're out of balance, right? Like empathy, whether it's that good side or dark side, like on either end, like if there isn't that balance, like empathy is the part that like creates the balance and understanding. And I don't know why, like, you know, you talked about like understanding the Separatists, and immediately I was thinking about like my favorite character and you know, Ahsoka's like empathy and trying to understand where Barriss was coming from and why Barriss betrayed her.
Yeah. Her friend Barriss Offee, who turned to the dark, or at like, least turned away from the Jedi.
No. We're not going to put that on her.
I always forget that, like when Ahsoka or Anakin battled Barriss Offee, that they weren't her red lightsabers. I just rewatched that episode like a week ago, and I was reminded, like, oh, she actually just like had Asajj Ventress's red lightsabers on her. She didn't like turn to the dark side in the most like serious way. It was just kind of a bad look. Or as she said, these are starting to look good on me. Yeah, I mean, the decline in empathy is like one of the reasons I wanted to include this in the book, because you just kind of like can say, I think, like, I could like go on TV tomorrow or just like talk to somebody like on a political event and be like, empathy is on the decline in America. And I think people would like believe that. Like, they just sort of feel it. I think when they get online, they feel it. When they look at their text messages and like see like the weird passive aggressive ways people talk to each other on a daily basis, they feel it. But it turns out like it actually has some basis in evidence. There's a number of studies that have been done on universities to try to gauge and measure empathy over the course of time, and one that stuck out to me in doing my research for this book was done at the University of Michigan, which since 1988 has been doing a series of studies on undergrad students when they come into the university and basically measuring different aspects of what they call their empathy. And there are different like sub brackets of empathy, but like just as sort of the catch-all term, they encompass all those as like the various questions we ask you are all meant to add up to, can these people put themselves in the shoes of others? Can they feel and relate to the experiences of others? And there's, again, a lot of subsections of the ways that they sort of tabulate that up. But on net, since 1988 to 2015, they were able to track a 40% decline and empathy amongst different sets of college students coming in. So like every cohort coming into school over that time period is experiencing less and less and less. And, you know, just as like, that's one data point. I take that honestly as being like all that I need to see. Because I just, again, it's one of those things that I just feel it out there in the world. One of the striking examples, which I lean on in my book, not lean on, but just mention because I thought it was interesting. Do you guys, are you familiar with Arthur Chu, the multi-time winner of Jeopardy?
I don't think so. No.
He is a like a prolific champion of Jeopardy, and he went and created a Twitter storm in the days after the January 6th riot insurrection event. There was a woman killed in that event by the name of Ashley Babbitt. Might be familiar with the name. She was when they were trying to bust through one of the doors, security shot through the door, struck her in the head, and she died and bled out in the Capitol building. Arthur Chu, this guy who's like known for being a multi-time Jeopardy winner and a kind of a lightning rod leftist online, he went on this tangent on Twitter, and I just have one of the tweets in front of me because they've now all been deleted. And he said this to describe the death of that woman, Ashley Babbitt. When a bullet goes through the fatty tumor a Nazi has in the space where a human being would have a brain, nothing is lost. And he goes on to talk about how it is the imperative of anybody who considers themselves to be anti-fascist to think of people like Ashley Babbitt or, you know, like literal Nazis as not human so that you can do the thing that needs to be done, which is kill them. And these tweets have all been deleted. But I wanted to include it in the book because you can't get more of like a graphic example of dehumanization as a political tool or as like a form of, what would be the word? A way to soothe like your own guilt that you might have about things that happen in the course of politics, which I found to be kind of disturbing. I've talked a long time. I apologize, but one of the examples that came to mind.
That makes a lot of sense. So I had something similar. I was a delegate to the DNC back in 2012. I think that was the one that was in Charlotte. And one of the rallying cries from the former governor of Michigan, I think, was that like Detroit and the auto industry is alive and Osama bin Laden is dead. And that was the like rallying cry of like 4 more years of Obama. And I found myself like unable to clap and cheer. And I was like, I need to unpack this. Like, it doesn't sit right with me that I am supposed to cheer that no matter how notorious or bad Osama bin Laden is, and I'm supposed to clap and cheer that this man is killed and dead. And that I couldn't, even in the space of like-minded individuals, you know, who were jubilant and, you know, excited to reelect President Obama and to do all the work and to nominate him. And like, that was like what we were claiming as his success and the victories is that, you know, Detroit is alive, Osama bin Laden is dead. And I just sat there on the floor of the convention in that moment. And I think that's like that triggering thing. Like, if you lose the ability to have empathy, to see the humanity or to see the value and the worth of others, even though those you disagree with, then there is an imbalance, right? Like there is, you can't move forward from that, right? Like you can't evolve, you can't grow, you can't change. And it is like a stunting. You have to stunt your own humanity to refuse to see and to empathize and to connect with the humanity in others. So, yeah, glaring to me. And in one of those moments where I, you know, was caught off guard and, you know, and I think there are examples all over of that, but that's my connection sort of to that, like, idea that, like, that's how we devolve. That's how we stop growing. That's how we stop moving forward.
Yeah. That example you gave of kind of just being in a crowd and in that similar kind of situation. I think anybody who's been involved in politics for even a minute has found themselves in a room of people clapping for a thing that you just like are supposed to clap for. And you will always like have a voice in your head. Hopefully, I hope you still have a voice in your head being like, why am I clapping for this? Is this like really in line with my values? Or is this like a team chant moment? And I just think about it a lot, and I actually I'm having a piece of artwork created for the book that I'm going to like give away as like a poster for the book. And it's going to be referencing the Bad Batch, where after the Bad Batch, the new Disney Plus series for Star Wars, after Order 66, the Bad Batch are standing amongst all the other clones on Kamino, and they are heralding the birth of the new Empire. All the stormtroopers kind of do their like little salute, like fist in the air, and the Bad Batch kind of all have their hands by their side, arms crossed, and notably their helmets off, which I think is this beautiful sign of like what makes the Bad Batch interesting, is just by nature of showing their faces, they are individuals beyond their genetic quirks when they are around other clone troopers and stormtroopers, soon to be stormtroopers. It kind of goes back to the August Landmesser photo from Nazi Germany, is the auto or naval worker in a crowd of Nazis all Sieg Heiling, who was photographed with his arms crossed. I believe his life ended up ending in a camp for political dissidents. But it's a powerful photo. In a crowd of people saluting, and you're like the one person crossing your arms. Anyway, I think about that in Star Wars like all the time, particularly because of people like Finn and the Bad Batch, who gave you permission to take that helmet off. It calls him a bug in the system, right? What is Captain Phasma calls him a bug in the system. Like that's what those little acts of thought crime, mental rebellion, not saluting are bugging somebody's system.
Yeah, Daniel, that was beautiful. Thank you for sharing that. I cannot say I would have not chanted if I were you. No, like just from, well, being honest, like I was very happy that we found in Joachim Milan. Would I have chanted that? Maybe. I don't know. But I will say that I think you hit the nail on the head. Time and space, though, like changes you, right? And giving yourself more time to really then allow your humanity to grow in ways. Would I do it now? Probably not, honestly, right? Having more time and space between these events, especially 9/11, being from New York City and all this stuff, like the time and space and understanding more and trying to be a better person, right? Those things definitely, hopefully, like then you said, see if in your voice in your head, it continues to be there. It can just push you to change and to be better. Hopefully that is there. I was thinking of this actually with my kids when we were watching the end of when they redid Clone Wars, right? When that redid it, they finished the Clone Wars, the final season, whatever we call it now, season 4.5, whatever it is. Seven. I don't know, guys. Like, I don't know these things anymore. But the whole battle, that final battle where one of the final battles between Anakin and Obi-Wan, they're leading a charge on the droid army somewhere in some planet. I can't remember what it's called now, but there's a lot of destruction, right? There's like a lot of destruction. And it was one of the first times, and it's been pretty recently, but it allowed me to help draw, at least for my children, this gray area. Whereas, yes, the good guys won, but at what cost? At what cost of life did we do these things? And, you know, really pointing out, like, but yeah, guys, how many people might have died in those buildings? Were they still there? What were the Jedi doing so well to protect light and life that they had to do this and destroy all these things, right? So, and then the clones, right? And I think that's another great aspect of the Star Wars saga that we really don't dive into. It's very similar to the loss of life when it comes to these kids that have been indoctrinated and taken from birth for the First Order, right? Like, and then you can get to the stormtroopers, like, you know, that though I think might be a little more, still, it's hard to say, right? Empathy, right? It's hard to say night and day, even like, oh, the stormtroopers got what they were deserving. You kind of understand that's not maybe the case, right? They were getting off so-and-so. They were conscripted into this. Like, when you start unraveling the easy narratives, right? I think that's where we're kind of getting to with empathy in the Star Wars universe. It just makes it messier, and it makes it more like life. And for so many people, again, I hate to say that. I'm not trying to, you know, hyperbolize for everybody out there and for humanity at writ large, but we are seeing that more folks want to opt out of that ability to have empathy for understanding of others because the narrative is easier if it is black and white, right? It is much harder to have a narrative in Star Wars if you go into the nuance of breeding people to die in the Clone Wars, taking kids that didn't want to be there, or even what was like life on Lothal that you didn't sign up to be a stormtrooper when you really didn't want to. And then you die in the Death Star, right? Like, that makes everything so much messier, which, I mean, but so I really appreciate this conversation to, again, think of those things and think it through, because hopefully elevates that need to see others than just that mask, right? It does elevate that.
Yeah. I mean, and like one of the things that I've been most disturbed about, on the political right, in my book, I take on a bunch of different ways in which I'm concerned about the left. But, you know, the thing about like the QAnon conspiracy theory is that the QAnon conspiracy movement is this movement that at its core allows its adherents and participants to absolve themselves of guilt for anything that they might do to fight what they considered to be their enemies, forces of evil, because Democrats are not just Democrats. They are not just people who favor higher taxes, different uses of government power, and teachers unions. They are pedophiles and Satanists who eat lost children, and they might eat your children too. And it's just kind of it's such a bizarre thing to even talk about, but you kind of have to now because it's so widespread. I have seen people in my own personal circles and family play footsie with that entire thing because they heard about it online and it's worth considering, isn't it? And I just get so grossed out because, again, what it allows you to do is remove moral culpability for the things that you might do in the course of fighting your opponents in a fair way. They're not people. They're Satanists and killers. That's one of the trends that I've just sort of been following pretty closely as a major point of concern. I want to put to both of you a quick question. What do you think is driving declines in empathy? And, you know, it could just be day-to-day stuff. It could just be like kids in school, or, you know, it could be, you know, our political discourse at large, you know, because this whole point about like the study at the University of Michigan that shows students, you know, generation over generation are coming in with a little bit less of an ability to walk in each other's shoes. What do you think's going on? What's changed?
I mean, our society has changed, right? Like, we have the internet, and it's a tool for good, and it's also a tool for bad, right? Like, you can self-select into the communities and the information and the groups that you want to learn in from, buy into, be a part of, right? Like, if you self-select and you get one truth and it's the truth you've chosen, then you don't have to understand or to understand the sides of others or empathize or anything like that, right? Like, you, and that's the difference. Even though I grew up in the 80s, I'm an 80s baby, happy about that. But I was a privileged 80s baby with like a Commodore 64 and an Apple IIe. And, but I, you know, we still had to go through like the AOL disk, free disk dial-up system, right? But outside of that, you know, 90s invention of the free CD-ROM in the mail, I still had to play with other kids, and like I didn't get to self-select the information that I received. We didn't have like 85,000 television channels that I could pick which news. We had like the 5 broadcast channels, and then maybe CNN.
That self-selection part of it is huge.
Yeah, right? So it's like I had to receive information, and the information I received most of the time was neutral. And I had to be around people who weren't the same as me. I couldn't self-select into certain groups. And I think that's the difference now. They can choose the chat rooms and choose the groups and the websites and what information they're going to receive from where. Am I going to get my information from Daily Coast or Daily Caller? You know, like, where am I going to fall on this spectrum, and where am I going to receive, like, what are my inputs coming in from? And I think that's the difference. And that's the decline, right? Like, you don't have to, I have no idea. I don't watch Fox News. Yeah. I have no idea what they say on Fox News. I don't care. I also don't watch like MSNBC or anything like that, but still, like maybe I get my news from BuzzFeed. I don't know. But it's one of those things where that's where the decline comes in. If you're not forced to look in the face of what's happening on the other side, and you don't have to see their humanity, you don't have to see their truth. Yeah. Sort of that same conversation that's happening around this like critical race theory conversation and like narrative that's going around our country right now. And it's like, if you can't.
Oh, that's an amazing example of how we're not like talking about the same things. And we like, nobody knows, like, when they are screaming about CRT, like, and then another person on the other side hears that, like, we're not talking about the same things. We need to set definitions. We need to talk about it's an incredible example. Like, what I tell people all the time, and I want to hear from Nick real quick, because you've pointed out like self-selection, and I think that's a really good one. But like, people like talk to me about like, what do you think about like the whole CRT in schools thing? And I'm like, well, first thing is that a lot of people think they're talking about CRT, but they're actually talking about anti-racism. And these are like different paths, different ideological ventures that you can go down. And it's very frustrating. Nick, what is another cause that you think might be contributing to empathy decline?
The Last Jedi. Is that the right answer, everybody? No, I'm kidding.
The Last Jedi destroyed empathy for generations to come. It was the porgs.
Nailed it. Nailed it for all of us. It was the porgs. I love me some porgs. No, I was actually, you know, I do think self-selection, and I read a book that Cass Sustein did. It's called Republic.com. I mentioned it before, maybe like years ago in my prime when, you know, I was reading books again. And it highlighted that, like, we should be worried about this. This was like 2000 something. It was early. It was like, you know, way when we were still using AOL as dial up, and I had T1 connections at college. Like, it was pre where we are now. And he nailed it on the head. Like, this is a problem. This is going to happen. We got to do something about it. And we did nothing about it. And here we are. However, I think there is more to that than just that answer of being we self-select. I think you need to also set back. Daniel said society has changed, period, in a very large way, that we have really undervalued and underestimated the impacts of our societal structure as it means to be neighbors, friends, volunteers, and people in each other's lives that then can build those bonds of communal respect because we have shared interests, because we don't do those things anymore. And I'm not a religious person. I mean, I was born Catholic, raised in New York, don't practice anymore. But there is, you know, I am worried as a non-believer, the decline in religious attendance because of the value it has towards community. Just as much as I am worried about the decline of volunteerism rates in communities, because when you start taking away those opportunities for people to give back and to see themselves as something larger, especially with people that they don't agree with 100% on anything on, it does release us from then the responsibility to see how people live and the responsibility to take into account what they've come through and what they've gone through. I'm not rolling off the PTA, but I just finished up my term as president. And, you know, I have an incredible amount of empathy for parents who can't do things because I realize how hard it is as a parent that has two parents that are working with three kids and a massive student loans and how tired we are every day and every week from trying to do the best we just for our kids to give them a better life and to work full time. And not to see each other anymore because we both work full time. And then to be expected to hold together this community somehow, right? Like, and do the things we need to do to hold the community together. And so often, like, I'm on now a different board of a museum here. And like, I'm doing other things instead when I roll off because I still feel that like value of if not me, then who? Yeah. Well, if not me, then who? Right. It's a driving principle for me. But I understand and I empathize with that level of societal burnout that we put on families and people now, like, especially, I mean, this generation's coming along, but I'm almost 40, those that are in this kind of age range and a little older, a little younger, the responsibilities that we have now are vastly different than they were during the '90s or beginning.
Well, I think actually what you're getting to here is actually what I wanted to build on. So I think this is a good moment to bring it up because in those University of Michigan studies that show the decline in empathy generation over generation going into college, they ended up coming to a root cause. And the top level reason that they came up with is social media use. Okay. So like big surprise, like exactly what Daniel was talking about, like social media is a lot of self-selection. You're getting stuff that is fed to you algorithmically based on the things that you might want to see or order your life around. But what is underneath social media use is actually the driving cause of empathy's decline. And it is distraction. It is the constant thinking about things going on beyond the scope of your actual life. It's wondering about when your next text is going to come in. It's when you're talking to a person on your phone, right? And then all of a sudden you just see the three dots in the text message and your mind is thinking about like, all right, when's the text going to come in? When's the text going to come in? And it takes you out of that moment. And I always try to think about Star Wars advice when I'm doing this stuff. And I, at the top of every chapter in the book, I've got a Star Wars quote. And I was like, what is the empathy quote that I wanted to leave people with? And it actually was something I did not expect. It's Qui-Gon to Obi-Wan in episode one, sharing the wisdom of Master Yoda when he says, keep your concentration here and now where it belongs. And what you mentioned about burnout, Nick, that is what I pinpoint and what I believe to be the driving declining factor for empathy in the world today. We're just so stretched then. We're so busy. And I have it in air quotes, like making ourselves busy with like all of the text threads that we're keeping up with, all of our retweets, all of our likes that we're tracking on LinkedIn and Instagram and Facebook. It's just that we're thinking about so much. And then when you get to the stop sign and the homeless person is there like shaking his can at you, you're not even in some cases in the old world, you would be looking at the light waiting for it to change. And therefore you see the homeless person. But I don't know about you. That's when I check my messages. That's now when I'm looking at my damn phone and not the person out the window, because I'm not even looking at the stoplight. It's just like we're not present. And I'm even willing to like go so far begrudgingly to say like this is part of the fruits and pains of capitalism, a society that is driven by creation, being busy, doing things, making money, and living well. And living well is always expanding in its definition. Our needs are always expanding. Therefore, we don't need to worry about other people as much.
No, yeah, I just want to jump in and say even that quote from Qui-Gon, you know, 20 something years later, I reflect on differently, because I kind of use that quote on my kids now, because they're always out in the distance thinking about stuff. I'm like, keep your mind in here and the now. Like, and I'm telling my kids the Yoda quote, always in that, you know, always looking to the horizon. You are a young Skywalker. Keep your focus in the moment. Like, there is a balance though to that though, right? And I think that's the beauty of Star Wars and trying to teach some lessons too, is that there is a balance that can be taught to capitalism. There is a need for looking towards the horizon, to be distracted by the things that are out there, for that growth, for opportunities, and to see things as a brighter future. That's hope, right? But then there's also that need to stay in the present and to be, I don't say distracted. I think you do hit on a good point though, Stephen. Like, there are definitely distractions in that regard, but to also be focused on the present, because you will miss things in the present by being distracted by the future, right? So you won't tend to your the garden that needs tending if you're worried about where you're going to plant the next forest, right? You have to at some point in time be concerned of those things around you. But yeah, even it's just funny you mentioned that quote too, because that's one of the things when I was like, I don't know, movie came out like 17, I was like, oh, Qui-Gon, you wrong. Like, Obi-Wan, he knows what he's talking about, you know, like. Now, being much older, I'm like, there's a fine point to both. But I do appreciate using that quote, because I think it does leave a lot to be thinking about when you think of empathy and the balance between the present and the future and how that relates to your own subconscious reaction to things around you.
No, I like the idea of like the quote being anchored in present, and I think the concept of like the study that it's anchored in distraction is, I think it's fascinating, and I think it's real, and I think we see that in our lives, and it's also mirrored in Star Wars, in everyone's favorite film. When Rose takes Finn to the casino planet. And he's like, this place is great. Like, what the hell are you talking about? And she's like, no, it's distraction. Like, you're distracted by the shiny things. And here's like the terrible reality of what's happening on the other side, you know? And I think even how we, as humans, and I try to, you know, I don't have the ability to turn off being empathetic. And it is exhausting. It is exhausting every day to feel. And then it's like, what cause can I not, like, do I care about the condo collapse and the missing people in Miami, or like the fact that like 800 children were found dead in Canada at like a, you know, Native Indigenous children, First Nation children found dead, graves unmarked in Canada? Or, you know, I think about the airstrikes that are now, the Biden administration has like said about like, you know, in Iran, their Syrian lines. And do I think about the civilians there, or like the Palestinians? And like, it's just overwhelming. And it's easier to just be like, no, right? It's easier to be distracted and to see the shiny things and the pretty things and the casino planet and be like, this place is great, and not see the harm. It's easier.
But even what you just described, Danielle, like all of that stuff, all of that feeling, that's like the suffering of an empath, where you're like, the world is hitting you and you feel all of it. And a lot of times then you feel powerless. Like, there's nothing I can do about any of this. and you either become numb to it and you start doing less, or you channel that into action and you do a thing. But I feel like all the stuff you just described, like internationally, like I almost like feel bad, because I'm like, I kind of like, I file that in my brain in the, who am I kidding if I say I'm like heartbroken about certain things that happen that are just not related to me. I'm heartbroken about things like that are in my orbit, things that touch me in a way. But like, I feel like the world like asks us to feel about things, like, and I mean like the corporate world like asks us to feel things for things like where it's just not natural for us to feel for. Does that make any sense? I feel like what I said was just very cold.
A little. The empath in me is like,
it goes against our nature.
I mean it's too much. Like, even like, think about like the month of June. You've got everything that happened last summer. So we were reliving Ahmaud Arbery and Breonna Taylor and George Floyd. And then we've got Juneteenth, which is now like, no one asked for it, but now it's a federal holiday. So now everyone's going to learn what Juneteenth is. And then you got, it's Pride Month. And then we have to, you know, that is a continuum of learning and growth and understanding new vocabulary, new experiences. And then, you know, on top of that, we also have to like reconcile all the other things that are happening. And sometimes you just want to sit and watch playoff hockey or get excited about the Olympic trials and cheer on Team USA and not think about the harm, because it's not just present harm that you have to empathize with, but you also have to empathize with the baggage and the past and the trauma that we conveniently as a nation or a culture haven't recognized, but that like still like it's harms. And then we have to think about the harms that are happening, that are perpetuating, like our climate and how do we recover from the pandemic, and like, do I still wear my mask in the grocery store, or like, you know, like, do, are these kids vaccinated? Like, it's just you suffocate under it. And I think that's too, like, but then you like come back to like the seed, and like as an empath, like the only thing I can do is go back to like my key Star Wars concept of hope. And like I'm going to keep going, and I'm going to just feel all these things. I'm going to do what I can because I hope it'll work out in the end. And you can either live that path, like, I hope it'll work out and I'll do my part, or you're just sort of like, well,
oh, I'm so glad you mentioned like hope is sort of like an antidote, because I'm going to take us off the Star Wars reservation over to X-Men, because I was just rewatching Days of Future Past. Don't make that face at me, Nick. Days of Future Past the other week. And the universe's ultimate empath in X-Men, Professor Charles Xavier, his younger self is down and out because he cannot take hearing the world and hearing the suffering of others, and he feels what people feel as a result. That's his mutant ability. So he feels all of it, he hears all of it, and he is taken to a drug addiction to suppress all of it. So we meet young Charles Xavier, and he's just shooting up into his arm to keep his powers at bay and not feel it. And he is basically, what he has done is he has capitulated to fear. He is afraid of feeling, and he's afraid of powerlessness. And his way out is actually seeing his future self through Wolverine. He hears about who he's going to be in the future. He sees himself. He's able to see who he can be. And then he discovers, he literally says it like that H word, like, I have hope, and you must have hope too, because we can do this. And I just like, it's that, that's thing. It's that feeling, the weight of the world on your shoulders, and you have a choice between fear and hope, and fear is the mind killer.
Yo, no, I got nothing. That was good. I don't know why I watched X-Men still, but no, it's fine.
That was really great.
To each their
own. I was like, wow. Hold on.
No X-Men. No X-Men allowed.
Marvel.
No, right? I mean, I was like, where's this going? We're going Days of Future Past. I was like, okay, this makes sense now. So it's good, Steven. You got multi genre talent, honestly. So
I know. It's the evolution of
Marvel politics.
I don't like any other franchises besides Star Wars and X-Men. Like, people think I'm like, oh, I'm a big geek, and like, oh, you want to like hang out and watch the new Loki? And I'm like, actually, no, I don't want to do that. My relationship is with the X-Men and with Star Wars and like almost nothing else.
Well, it's funny though, because you mentioned it, because I feel like, I mean, and I don't want to take us too far either, but like, if anything is really political in the Marvel Universe, X-Men is like right there, right? Mutant rights, the like viewing people as less than, you know, like because they're different. Like, if anything hits on the thing, at least when I remember reading the X-Men back in the 80s and 90s and some of the storylines they told, like if anything hit on that as hard as a Marvel franchise, it was definitely the X-Men. And
the choice of how you fight.
Yeah, yeah, right, right. And the choice of how you fight, Magneto and Charles Xavier, right? Like, I think, that's a natural progression for something when you talk about empathy and seeing hope and a better sense of yourself and the world you want to create. And it comes, I mean, I'll bring it back to Star Wars, right? Like, I think hope maybe is not, hope as an antidote to some of that fear is correct, but I think hope as the primer for empathy, right? Like as the fuel to empower us to really see a better world by having a better understanding of the choices of others and how they got there. And I think to a certain point too, like Steven, you have to have a line that, and it's really hard. It's murky, right? Like you have to have some sort of line to not cross when you're going that far down the empathy path in a way. You know, you have to have those, you know, QAnon things, right? Where you're like, I can understand why you might think this, but doesn't make it right. You know, yeah. Like this is not how this should go. And there's obviously no guidebook for us to figure that out. But,
this is actually probably where I think we'll wrap for today. And I will just invite y'all now to do a part two, because we haven't even gotten to the entire segment of the conversation that I want to do on masks and how we wear them, why we wear them, and the kinds of fronts that people put up so as not to receive the empathy of others, so that they can be the thing that they have been striving to be, even if that thing is kind of wicked. I just saw Cruella yesterday, and the Cruella de Vil origin story starring Emma Stone is like a really interesting example where like she has this like split personality between her real self, Estella, and then this alter ego of Cruella. And one has to die so the other can live. And these are like, this is the Sith thing. Ben Solo has to die for Kylo Ren to live. And they both cannot be around because it drains the power of the other. And this is like how we protect ourselves so we can self-actualize, even if it's to our detriment. Danielle, I want to give you just like closing word on kind of where we're at on this, and we're going to like wrap it for part one and we'll do a part two.
I appreciate this discourse because it's actually challenged me in a way, even as an empath, to sort of understand why others aren't as empathetic. And as an empath, I will tell you that's one of the most frustrating things. It's like, I understand you, why don't you understand me? And the energy and the exhaustion in trying to explain and to you know, so one of my favorite song lyrics is by this guy called, his group name is Sleeping at Last. And he went through the Enneagrams. And one of the lyrics in Enneagram 9 is that it looks like empathy to like see through others' eyes, but I'm just trying to see myself through someone else's eyes. Like, it seems like it's empathy for me to understand where you're coming from, but I just want to see what I'm like. Like, I need to understand your perspective so I know how I show up in your view, so I can understand myself better. And I always have to navigate that as an empath. I want people to understand why things matter to me. And I think that's where we are in this world, in this twisted world, where it's just, you know, it's like, it's helpful in this conversation and to, you know, even revisiting Star Wars and thinking like it's exhausting and it's tiresome. And some people just can't. I have to be more empathetic to understand that, like, the distraction and the cutting off of empathy is their way of protecting their own sanity and protecting themselves. That it's not cruel. It's not bad. It's not wholly good or wholly evil. They're not bad guys. It's just hard to carry all the weight of everything. And everyone, you know, not everyone has the same skills or tools to be able to hold that. So that's like been, it's been really actually helpful for me in my own growth journey in this last hour to sit there and be like, oh, like, no, QAnon people are crazy sauce. I'm like, oh, no, maybe they're just scared. And maybe there's a reason.
Yeah, I think it's the QAnon thing, because this has sort of seeped so much into evangelical Christian communities, the QAnon theory. It's one of those things where I think it's really important to believe that these are people who their operating belief system is in a God, in Christ, in creation, and a second coming. And they have given into despair. Like, the Christians who I've talked to who believe this stuff, they're not going to church anymore. That thing that kept them from being kind of a psycho in this world, because like, when you're a Christian, you believe the world is fallen, you believe like there's only so much that can be done, and Christ is going to come back and I'm going to go be with him, and that kind of keeps them from being this awful person. And then they're not going to church anymore. They're talking to you about QAnon. And you're kind of freaked out by it, and you have to go like, oh, are you having a faith crisis? Like, have you lost hope in your God, the thing that ordered your entire life? Because this thing is your God now, like golden calf kind of stuff. Moses has gone up to the top of the mountain and he's not coming back. Therefore, we need this new God. It's sad. I mean, it really is sad. And I try to remember that when I'm the most frustrated. because these people have given up hope on not only the world that they live in, but the world that comes after in their view. And even what you were just saying about self-protection, and I will just round out with this story, is I wanted to speak to somebody about the whole idea of Kylo Ren meeting with Rey. The mask coming off and then Rey having to kind of reorder her view of him. And so I wanted to reach out to this guy. His name is Bishop Omar, and I got him on a Zoom call at the very beginning of the pandemic to talk about how he has seen that play out in his work ministering to gang members behind bars. And most of these gang members are in for murder. By nature of the gangs that they are in, they're either doing time for their initiation killings or whatever, like, right? Most of them have killed a guy. And Bishop Omar was talking to me about how they survive in prison. And I think both of you probably know this, is that once you're in prison, you just do more crime to survive. And you kind of have to go deeper into the world in order just to survive and get back out to the people who you love. And he was like, these guys, these young men, these boys, they adopt a new version of themselves that is tied to the gang. And the only way in which they can survive once they've entered this world is to fulfill that new side of themselves and suppress their natural selves as much as they can. They have to suppress the child who just wants to go home to their mother or be home with their little brother. They have to be the gang member, because the gang member is the only thing that's going to keep them from getting killed at their next outdoor time or in the cafeteria the next morning. They have to be that person. And at some point, one of those two personalities can kill the other. And his job working behind bars is to remind them and drive for them every time he sits down for them for a mentoring session that they can go back to the person they were before, but it's going to be really hard. And it's going to be scary. And they're going to feel like they don't have the protection that their gang and their gang self offers them. And I was just like, my mind blown. Because this is the Sith way of living. Like, this is the Darth Vader syndrome. This is the life behind the mask. And folks, we will wrap it there for this episode, a part one of two parts on empathy. That's it for this episode of Beltway Bantha, Star Wars Politics, and more. You might notice in your podcast feed, I actually finally changed the title of this podcast to just Beltway Banthas. For the longest time, if you've been listening to this show for a while, and I know many of you have, it's always been Beltway Banthas : Star Wars Politics and More. And it is actually now just Beltway Banthas. It is listed differently. And I don't really know why I did it. I just kind of felt like it was just the right thing to do. People call this Beltway Banthas. So now it is officially just called that in your podcast feed. I mentioned at the beginning of the episode, there will be a part two of this. We're going to continue this conversation on Star Wars and empathy and go a little bit deeper, because I really want to spend some time talking about masks, how they work, why Star Wars is so intent sometimes in masking its villainous characters, even some of its heroes like Finn and Rey in the beginning of episode 7 are a good example of that, and what that symbolizes, what that means, and then how we wear masks in our own lives in ways that make it hard for people to relate to us. And sometimes we do it as a self-defense mechanism. Sometimes we wear masks and we are not even aware of it. So we're going to do that on another episode coming very soon. I really hope you enjoyed this. My guests were Danielle Adams and Nick DeCalandria. And as if I have not plugged it enough already, folks, the book is up for pre-order. The one that I've been talking about for like 2 years now is actually now a real thing. It's called How the Force Can Fix the World: Lessons on Life, Liberty, and Happiness from a Galaxy Far, Far Away by yours truly. It is a book inspired by this podcast, by this audience, the discussions that have been had on this show for years on end about Star Wars and how it can make you a better person. I turned it into a book. It's 7 chapters plus a really great introduction, epilogue, and a foreword by some very interesting politicos who you will be excited to read from. And it is coming out on October 26th. It is up for pre-order right now. You can find a link to it in the show notes. And you can also just search How the Force Can Fix the World over on Amazon, Barnes & Noble's, and anywhere that you get your books, you will find a place where you can get this book. It has original artwork on the inside, beautifully done by a listener to this show, which is so cool. One of the listeners of this show reached out and was like, hey, I'm really excited about the book. I've pre-ordered it. And I looked into this person. I was like, I just like do what I do, check their LinkedIn, check their Instagram, be like, okay, I know what this person has. It turns out they're an illustrator. And so I reached out and I was like, I actually have been thinking about trying to get some illustrations in this book, some original artwork. Would you like to do it? And lo and behold, they did. And now that art is going to be in the book and it is stinking gorgeous. Just beautiful. And if you want a Star Wars book that tackles important contemporary issues with heart, with artistic vibe, with originality, this is the book for you. And it is all based on this podcast, which you are listening to right now. So please, 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 please go check it out. How the Force Can Fix the World, online now, and it will drop and mail to you in October. That is it for this week's episode of Beltway Banthas. I've been your host, Stephen Kent. You can find me on Twitter on the tweet machine at Stephen_Kent89 and Beltway Banthas at Beltway Banthas. I'm always down for a chat. You can message me anytime and email us at beltwaybanthas@gmail.com. I will get back to you. It's been a pleasure talking to you today, and we'll be back next month with more. Until then, may the Force be with you always.